culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It is officially Columbus Day. Yeah, it is. Still all across the country, even though the President of the United States just issued a proclamation, first time a president ever did this, that today is actually Indigenous Peoples Day. And it's been declared Indigenous Peoples Day, not by the federal government, but by a number of governments across the country. Is this ever going to get resolved? Are we supposed to be celebrating both simultaneously? How does that fit together? We will get to all of that coming up on the Michael Medved Show. But first up, I mean, most people, I think, would agree that the most important factor in American life is the survival of the family and how you raise children. And if you heard or learned that there are 800,000 children a year who actually are taken away from their caregivers, either their parents or their foster parents or their adoptive parents or whoever it happens to be, and fall into a system that is currently a howling mess, you'd say, well, why haven't I heard about it? Well, you're going to hear about it a little bit now, and you will hear about it a great deal and with some detail in an extraordinary new book, which is called No Way to Treat a Child: How the Foster Care System, Family Courts, and Racial Activists Are Wrecking Young Lives. The author is the always excellent Naomi Schaefer Riley. She has written other fine books. You know her work appearing in leading publications around the world, including the Wall Street Journal, frequently. Naomi, congratulations on the book. She is also a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, who focuses on issues regarding child welfare. Naomi, congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to talk to you again.
Thank you. The question that I know is going to be first for a lot of people speaking to you about the book, and I apologize for just asking the obvious question, but what led you to this passionate interest in what people have called the forgotten or disappeared children of America who are taken up in this foster care system?
Well, there are a couple of things that sort of led me in this direction. As you recall, a few years ago, I actually wrote a book about American Indians, and I visited a lot of reservations in this country and Indian territories, and there are some of the worst child welfare outcomes in the country in those communities, a rate of maltreatment that is twice the national average for children there, and a child welfare system that is just a disaster, and especially because it includes something called the Indian Child Welfare Act, which means that we are much more concerned with whether a child's race matches the race of foster adoptive parents than we are about the child's best interest. And so when I got done with that project, which was so disturbing to me in so many ways, the way children had been abused, neglected by both their parents and then by the system, I kind of wondered how the rest of the children in the foster care and child welfare system were being treated. And I have to say, in many ways, it's not much better. The outcomes are pretty terrible. And I really started to look at the underlying ideologies that were guiding the state child welfare agencies, and it's pretty disturbing stuff.
Okay. First of all, you talked, the outcomes are appalling. What's the classic way or the right way to measure outcomes for a foster care system?
Well, I think just to give your listeners some basic numbers. So there are about 3 million reports every year that come in of a child being abused or neglected in this country. About 800,000 of those are substantiated, meaning that we know something has gone wrong in those homes. That doesn't mean, by the way, that the other, 2.2 million are not real cases of abuse or neglect, just that we did not find evidence there to support that charge. Then what happens after that is that there are about 450,000 kids in our country who are currently in the foster care system. Now, obviously, the foster care system is supposed to be something that's temporary, but unfortunately, for far too many many children, they languish in that system for a very long time. About a quarter of the kids in those systems, in that system, are available for adoption, meaning that their parental rights have already been terminated, but we have been unable or unwilling in some cases to find permanent, safe, loving homes for them. And then when you look at the rest of the kids, we are really supposed to be trying to find a way to find, you know, good homes for them as soon as possible. In some cases, you know, we think that means reunifying them with their families. In some cases, that means finding adoptive homes. Unfortunately, we are really ignoring the timelines for these children, and we are just letting them languish in the system. So the average amount of time that a child spends in the foster care system is 20 months. In some states, it's much higher. In New York, it's actually 30 months. So this is kind of, they're living in a kind of state of permanent limbo, almost, while we try to figure out whether we can rehabilitate their parents. And in most cases in the child welfare system, unfortunately, things like substance abuse and alcohol abuse and mental illness are really the issue with the parents. And as we know, it is very difficult to rehabilitate those kinds of situations. We feel very bad for the parents, and so we give them as many chances as possible. But for a child who is very young, you know, say under the age of five, the idea that we would wait years for their parents to clean up their act before saying, you know, we can't let this go on any longer, I think is a shame.
Okay, you talk about 300,000 children, and it's 800,000 children apparently every year who have some interaction with this system.
Mm-hmm.
For most of those children, how would the system first get wind of them? And they don't come in and say, we need help.
Right.
It's somebody who reports something that's gone terribly wrong.
Right. So in this country, we have something called mandated reporters. Those are people like teachers, doctors, social workers, law enforcement agents, you know, who have been trained to spot signs of abuse and neglect. And they make reports to child abuse hotlines that exist in every state. Once we get those reports in, then we send out people, you know, investigators to find out what is going on in those homes. Unfortunately, what happens then is that these investigators that many of these agencies have are not very well trained. There's a high turnover rate of these folks. They really are not, you know, there's a 40% turnover rate in some of these agencies. It's quite incredible. We train them in sort of, you know, ideologies of social work. You know, we train them in cultural and racial sensitivity, but in fact, they're doing jobs that are much closer to investigations like law enforcement does. We're asking them to go into dangerous situations, to knock on doors where they don't know who's on the other side, to ask probing questions about the way children in that home are being treated. There are often people who have been convicted of violent crimes living in those homes. We're asking them to think about the relationships of people in those homes. You know, something that comes up often is what's called the mother's boyfriend problem, essentially a non-relative male who is living in the household with those children. We're asking them to look for signs of substance abuse, you know, signs that, for instance, the parents are just out to lunch. Maybe the electricity has been turned off, or the water's not running, or there's no heat in the middle of winter. And so that is kind of how they first come into contact and how we have to make judgments about whether those children are going to be safe in those homes. Unfortunately, the people making those judgments are not very good at this.
And what's the proof that they aren't very good at it?
Well, I think one thing that you see, I mean, there are about 2,000 child maltreatment fatalities every year in this country. And the vast majority of those fatalities, I think people often get a kind of misunderstanding of the situation when they read the headlines. They see, you know, cases of children who were locked in the basement and their parents were torturing them and we had no idea what was going on. You know, they interview the neighbors. Oh, they were so nice. We never knew. In fact, the vast majority of cases are cases where we are actually well aware that there is something amiss in that family. There have been multiple reports of abuse or neglect leading up to those situations. You know, you saw this, for instance, recently. There are three very high-profile child fatalities in New York City just in the last couple of months. And they were
Naomi, yes. can you hang on? I want to continue this about
Absolutely. Your
book, No Way to Treat a Child, How the Foster Care System, Family courts and racial activists are wrecking young lives. Particularly, we get to the racial point of view, which is always controversial. That and more with Naomi Schaefer Riley coming up. He's called capitalism the greatest thing humanity ever accomplished, and he warns that socialism is trickle-up poverty. He's internationally acclaimed Whole Foods CEO and free market champion, John Mackey. The numbers are staggering, just staggering and shocking and horrific, and it's one of those things that this should not be a political issue, but inevitably it's going to have to be. When you have 440,000 children who are removed from their families and placed in foster care every year, 800,000 children every year who are found to have been abused or neglected by their caretakers. And it's one of those things that every person I've ever spoken to who's had contact with the foster care system has been shocked at it. And yet we don't fix it. Maybe it's because people don't have any concept of how. Naomi Schaefer Riley does. She's the author of the new book, which I think is going to have a profound impact. It's called No Way to Treat a Child, How the Foster Care System is at Family Courts and Racial Activists Are Wrecking Young Lives. Naomi, if you were talking about the most pressing, most important alterations in the system that we need, give an example of two or three.
So I think the first thing that we need to understand is that family preservation and family reunification are the driving ideologies behind child welfare agencies. Now, of course, to you and I, Michael, that sounds perfectly reasonable. Children belong with their families. Why wouldn't you want to reunify them or keep them with their families as much as possible? But these are caregivers who have mistreated them and mistreated them severely. And so we need to ask, really, why are we trying to push these families back together so quickly and so determinedly? I mean, when a woman is abused by her husband or boyfriend, we do not send the police there and have them ask immediately, how can we get you guys back together? But that is exactly what we do in the case of child abuse and child neglect. So the first thing we need to do is I think we need to really put child safety back at the center of this, put the child's best interest first. I think the second reform we need to keep in mind is that a child's timelines are different than a parent's timelines or than adult's timelines. If you say to a child who is in the system, who is 2 or 3 years old, oh, you know, just give the parents another 6 months, just give the parents another year, I'm sure they'll figure it out, they'll get off drugs, they'll learn how to parent, they'll learn how to handle their anger. Those are precious years of a child's life that are being frittered away and will have a severe impact on their social, emotional, intellectual, every kind of development you can imagine. The last reform that I think is so important and is really just pushing against the culture these days is to say that the most important thing for a child is to be in a safe, stable, loving home. That matching a child's skin color with the skin color of their caretakers is not the most important thing. This seems perfectly reasonable, I think, to most Americans. But when you say that to people inside the child welfare agencies, they think that the most important thing for a child is that they get to retain their quote-unquote culture. And so we have a law in the books called the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act, which actually bars discrimination when you're placing a child for foster care adoption. This country is now filled with activists who want to overturn that law, who want to say, yes, I want to ask in court when I have a black child who is going to be taken in by a loving, stable white family, we want to ask in court whether really that's okay or whether the child wouldn't actually be better off in the foster care system.
Okay. In terms of what happens to the children once they go into the foster care system, are there enough people, enough families out there that are willing to be foster parents to handle the press of some of these abused, battered, unhappy, and very vulnerable children? Are there enough families to take them in?
No, there are absolutely not enough families. Every state in the country reports a shortage of foster families. And most foster families, actually about half of foster families, quit within the first year of doing it. It is very hard work But when you ask families why it is that they left, why it is that they couldn't take the system, it's not because of the children. As difficult as their situations may be, as traumatized as they may have been, as difficult as their behavior is, most foster parents who leave say it is the system that has broken them down. It is the way they are treated so horrendously by the bureaucracy. They're treated like glorified babysitters. They could be taking care of a child for years, and, you know, some caseworker might just decide they don't like them anymore and just take a child away. Or they might go to court to see what is going to happen to this child, and the judge will tell them, oh, you're just foster parents. I'm not interested in what you have to say. So I have to say, like, the one, you know, kind of light for me in this story and the part that I most enjoyed about getting to report on this topic was getting to see how churches and faith-based communities around the country were really rallying around this cause. They have created a kind of revolution in the area of foster care, and they are doing so much work to try to find qualified, loving, stable families for these kids. And I hope we do everything we can to encourage their work.
Well, now, of course, and again, it's they're inspiring people, inspiring individuals, and inspiring stories that are in the pages of your book, No Way to Treat a Child. The old idea where people, I think, have Little Orphan Annie ideas of orphanages, that's no longer a major factor in American life with foster children, is it?
No, there are very few orphanages, certainly as such, and there are even fewer and fewer group homes now, actually to the point where it's turning into a problem. I obviously, you know, for most kids, living in a family is obviously the best situation for them, but some of these kids have been so traumatized, are dealing with such horrible mental illness, behavioral problems, that they actually need to spend some time in a congregate care or group home kind of facility in order to sort of relearn how to live in a family. Unfortunately, we have a situation in Congress now and in the states where we've said, oh, we think children belong in families, and we think some of these homes are just, they're just mean, and we should shut them down and eliminate funding. The problem is that this is sort of the magical thinking that goes on in the child welfare system. You know, this year there were 400 kids in Texas who were sleeping in offices. The reason they're sleeping in offices is because we have not, on the one hand, recruited enough foster families, quality foster families to take them in, and then we've also said, oh, we don't like group homes either, so we're going to shut those down. Well, the kids have to go someplace. This has happened in Washington and Oregon and West Virginia and Texas. And why are these kids sleeping in offices? It's because we don't have a realistic understanding of the system, and we are driven by ideology, not by what is best for the kids.
I think that any parent or grandparent or anyone out there who actually cares about America's kids, and particularly kids who are having a very tough time, is going to want to read No Way to Treat a Child, the new book by Naomi Schaefer Riley. Any chance you'll get to give congressional testimony? I would hope so, if some of these reforms can actually be processed and considered. Naomi, congratulations on the book, and thanks as always for your contribution. When we come back, so what about Indigenous Peoples Day? Today, we'll talk about it and more coming up on The Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Show, there is nothing but bad news for Democrats. If you look at the polling, if you look at the analysis, if you look at two progressive Democrats who basically are suggesting the Democrats have no chance of holding their Senate tie or getting a Senate majority either next time or in 2024, that the prospects right now, the analysis concerning the way that the public is responding to President Biden and his leadership, let alone the kind of resentment and disgust people have with Vice President Harris, all of this is desperate, it's dark, It's very pessimistic for the Democratic side. Only one hope, only one savior, only one individual with the strength and the power and the ability to make the Democrats competitive in 2024. Joe Concha, who is a political commentator who is not a Democrat. He is a media and political columnist for The Hill and a contributor for Fox News and on Twitter. Joe, okay, who is the one figure who might allow the Democrats to have a competitive race in 2024?
Michael, you set that up nicely. Well, his name is, I'll do it in the Sebastian Gorka voice, Donald J. Trump. That's who that savior is. And people say, well, what are you, crazy? I mean, the guy had 74 million votes. He beat Hillary, and no one thought he would. His popularity is climbing right now as Biden's is going down. Why would Donald Trump be able to save the Biden-Harris train wreck? And it's quite simple. As somebody who analyzes media and politics, I could tell you, and this is one of the more obvious and fourth-grade kind of statements I could possibly make, but as we know, that when Donald Trump is on the stage, right, and we're talking whether it's rallies, whether he's a candidate, whether he's president, he blots out the sun in terms of media coverage. Ask those 17 people he ran up against in 2016. They never had a shot because all the focus was on Trump. And in the 2020 election, all the focus was on Trump to the point where Joe Biden got away with almost not doing any campaigning, not taking any questions, not really, or any tough questions anyway, and basically won the presidency by pleading the fifth and running on a platform that said, vote for me, I'm a nice guy, I'm not that guy, basically what was the message. And now here we are where you have Joe Biden. He's in the White House right now because he's not Bernie Sanders and he's not Donald Trump, but now he actually has to govern. And on the whole governing thing, it couldn't be going any more horrifically, to your point, for this administration. And we're only less than 10 months in. That's basically a hockey season at this point. Because you look at, Michael, inflation, right, and the economy, and he's polling in the 30s there, inflation at a 30-year high. Jimmy Carter, hello, anyone? Oh, speaking of Carter, the Middle East is a mess because of Afghanistan and the horrible withdrawal that we had out of there, the fatal withdrawal that we had, and that is on Biden, of course. Then you look at the border. It is essentially open. You're going to have 2.3 million migrants coming into this country illegally in 2021. That's the same number as the population of Houston, our fourth largest city. And then obviously you look at crime in American cities, and people are leaving there in droves because it's expensive to live there, and they don't feel safe there anymore. So I could go through the litany, but if even
you don't have to. So the question,
victory,
the question,
Michael, not one. Sorry.
Yeah, the question that you have to go here is that, okay, given all of that, and I agree with your summary. I think things have gone horribly for the Biden administration by and large. Mm-hmm. But the question is, why wouldn't that set up a situation where people say, let's go back to the good old days when Donald Trump was president and we had all kinds of entertaining tweets and we had press conferences? The media would love to see Trump run, don't you agree? And to be the nominee and to then again compete and lose to whoever the Democrats put up.
You know what the irony is? That the people that would benefit the most would be liberal media, right? CNN, MSNBC. CNN alone has lost 80% of their audience since the beginning of the year. Can you imagine that? 8 in 10 gone. Now, to answer your question, I think it helps Biden and Harris, however, if they could go back to the good old days of 2020 when they could run again on "We're not Donald Trump." And Trump, unfortunately, The coverage of him almost always comes down to his personality, right? It always comes down to the man and not the policies. And before COVID, Donald Trump was a highly successful president, right? I mean, you had a roaring economy and we were at peace abroad. ISIS was, that caliphate was destroyed. North Korea was no longer threatening us, and that whole situation was dismissed. And the border was actually a border where laws were enforced. All those things were good. And then COVID brought it all back. My argument in the column that I wrote for The Hill today that apparently is doing quite well, is the fact that if you nominate, say, somebody who believes in all the things that Trump did and acted on, and then you have that person without the baggage of Trump, where I don't have to see January 6th on a loop for 2.5 years while he's running for president, or I got to hear all these things about him being a white supremacist and a totalitarian and all this stuff.
Wait, and it's a question. You've got to hear all kinds of claims of they stole the election. You make the point in your column that it's disastrous. And Trump, in his speech in Iowa, he spent over half an hour talking of his 90-minute speech in Iowa this weekend, talking about the stolen election and
That's
about
exactly
voting
right.
machines and ballots. And that doesn't work for him, does it?
No, and he keeps relitigating this election. And look, those crowds at those rallies, it's what they want to hear, and it gets the biggest applause lines. But for those independents in states like Georgia that he lost by 10,000 votes, in Arizona that he lost by 12,000 votes, in Wisconsin where he lost by one percentage point, Michigan, Pennsylvania also very, very close, they don't want to hear it. They want to hear, how are you going to make my life better again? How are you going to bring inflation down? How are you going to bring crime down? How are we going to get Afghanistan under control? All these things, they want to hear about that. They don't want to hear about 2020 anymore. I use this analogy. You know, the 1985 St. Louis Cardinals got hosed in the World Series. One of the worst calls you'll ever see when they're about to clinch the whole thing. They end up losing it. Did they spend the 86 season still complaining about that call? Or do you move forward and say, look, maybe I thought that I won that election, but I'm not going to talk about it anymore. I'm going to talk about the future and how we can bring this country back to where it was pre-COVID 2019. If he says that, he wins easily, no problem, but he does not have any discipline. He can't let it go. And as long as he keeps bringing it up, it's going to be, people are going to be like, yeah, you know, I like Trump, and I believe in a lot of things that he did, but I can't listen to this anymore. He sounds like a whiner and a complainer. And do we need two presidents, honestly? If Biden wins, he's in his 80s. Trump wins, he's in his 80s. Maybe we could have somebody like Trump, like a Ron DeSantis of Florida, who does a lot of great things. He's a war veteran, and he's governing the state extremely well. He's not afraid of the media. He knows where to push back. He's a Harvard educated. He brings you all the Trump things without the Trump baggage, and that was my overall conclusion in the article, that if you could get DeSantis versus Harris or DeSantis versus Biden in any election, it would be a landslide that we haven't seen since Ronald Reagan 1980 or 84. If Trump runs, then it's a toss-up, quite frankly, because so many people that would have voted against Biden would be like, well, either they're not going to vote or they hold their nose and do it because it comes down to Trump's personality and not the issues and not the policy. I hope that all makes sense.
Oh, it does, but you make the point that you think it's unlikely that Trump would step aside, and you believe it's unlikely that DeSantis or anyone else who is a formidable candidate would actually challenge him. Are you so sure about that latter point, that none of these ambitious younger Republicans might challenge Trump even if he insists on coming back?
I think the only one that could give him a serious challenge would be DeSantis, but when you have a guy who got more votes than any Republican presidential candidate in history by a country mile in Trump, that is a really, really hard thing to overcome. And again, DeSantis would have to really fight for media attention, would get it all. It mostly would be negative, but still, they would put him on screen and film an empty podium waiting for him to come to a rally before they'd ever have DeSantis doing some sort of policy discussion. So I think he'd have a puncher's chance, Michael, but it would be very difficult against Donald Trump, given all the attention.
See, there are so many people in recent politics, if you go back 50 years, who came out of nowhere. No one would have anticipated. But people like Gary Hart, when he ran the first time and made a real race of it. People like Jimmy Carter, who came out of nowhere and went to nowhere. But it's all fascinating and always great to speak to Joe Concha. His piece that appeared in The Hill magazine is posted up at our website. When we come back, the meaning of the dispute between Columbus Day today and Indigenous Peoples Day today, coming up.
I'm, of course, deeply honored to receive
The Michael Medved Show.
And a little bit later in this very segment, we will interview, as the music indicates, the 25th and a lot of people say final James Bond movie. It's certainly going to be the final one with Daniel Craig playing 007. We will get to that coming up on The Medved Show. It's already done more than $50 million at the box office. People coming back to theaters. Today is also a weekend day, part of the three-day weekend, because it is Columbus Day. So President Biden issued a statement for Columbus Day, but he also gave formal recognition with a formal White House statement for Indigenous Peoples Day. President Biden has proclaimed Monday, October 11th, that would be today, as Indigenous Peoples Day, becoming the first U.S. president to formally recognize the day. So who says that Joe Biden hasn't hasn't made any important changes. What he said is, he said this in his proclamation: for generations, federal policies systematically sought to assimilate and displace Native people and eradicate Native cultures, Mr. Biden wrote in the proclamation issued on Friday. Today, we recognize indigenous peoples' resilience and their strength, as well as the immeasurable positive impact that they have made on every aspect of American society. Every aspect of American society? there's no question that any group of people that has been around in the United States, there are people who have served in the military with great distinction. There are people who've won distinction in a whole range of fields, particularly if you count the many, many people who have mixed race background, with some Native American, Native people background, and also some white European background. But just talking about immeasurable contributions to every aspect of American society. Over the past several years, reports the New York Times, states including Alaska and New Mexico have adopted Indigenous Peoples Day, choosing to forego Columbus Day celebrations and heeding calls from indigenous groups and other residents not to celebrate Christopher Columbus, the Italian navigator the holiday is named for, who they say brought genocide and colonization to communities that had been in the United States for thousands of years. Many around the country, however, still celebrate Columbus Day or Italian Heritage Day as a point of pride in Italian culture. Not all states have accepted Indigenous Peoples Day, and some members of indigenous communities say recognizing the day does not go far enough. It is not yet a federal holiday, though there is a bill in Congress, of course, that proposes to make it one. Okay, this all comes at a time when, of course, the attacks on Christopher Columbus involve statues. There's this ridiculous story in Philadelphia, I'm afraid. A Christopher Columbus statue in Philadelphia, in South Philly, which is a largely Italian-American community traditionally. It's where my dad grew up. And at the time that he was there, there was a smattering of Ukrainian Catholics, a whole bunch of Jewish people, many of them from Ukraine, and then a whole bunch of Italians, but prominently Italians. So they have a Christopher Columbus statue in South Philly. The Philadelphia Commonwealth Court Judge Paula Patrick overturned a lower court's ruling on Friday that would have removed the box that they have put around the statue of Christopher Columbus, so that nobody in South Philadelphia could have their eyes offended or their soul pierced by even looking at an image of what they think Columbus looked like. They're not really even that sure. The statue is located in South Philly's Marconi Plaza, where Sunday's parade will end, and has been shut inside a wooden box since last summer's civil unrest sparked by the police murder of George Floyd. What exactly does George Floyd have to do with Christopher Columbus? Absolutely nothing, but never mind. The statue in the plaza became a site of several violent clashes between opposing protest groups. Now, with all of this, I was pleased to see there are two excellent columns, both of them worth reading, both of them worth posting, in defense of Christopher Columbus. And one of them in particular is by Garry Kasparov, who was an American patriot, a former Russian. I mean, he's still a Russian, but he's a former citizen of the bad old Soviet Union, and of course a former international chess champion. He's chairman of the Renew Democracy Initiative and the Human Rights Foundation. And he writes, Columbus, who achieved great things, is worthy of being honored for those things with a national holiday. His incredible feats of exploration were due to individual qualities that Americans should find admirable, and once did, in near unanimity. Holding historical figures to modern standards of morality is a method of ahistorical political control, much like the pseudo-history I grew up being taught in the Soviet Union. He says, this caricature of Columbus as little more than a rapacious villain is as simplistic and wrong-headed as the version of him as a savior hero who proved the world was round. As usual, reality is complex and doesn't provide easy, comfortable answers. As I said, I'm not here to praise the man, but to celebrate his deeds. Columbus taught himself Latin to study ancient and medieval manuscripts for clues about the circumference of the globe and his prospective journeys. True, his calculations were wildly off, overestimating the size of Asia and underestimating, by three-fourths, the size of the globe. But he also knew that he had to make the mission around sound easier, like any other startup seeking venture capital. Columbus yearned to fulfill the prophecy of Seneca's Medea. An age will come after many years when the ocean will lose the chains of things and a huge land lie revealed. And so he did, in four remarkable voyages that charted and changed the world. And he said there should be no place for whitewashing and jingoism in the service of a supposedly patriotic agenda or any agenda. We must teach the good and the bad of our leaders, our founders, and our heroes and saints. Otherwise, myths take hold too easily, such as the Confederate lost cause left to fester like an open wound. Its infection has spread into the 21st century. There should be no honoring those who fought a war against the Union to preserve the evil institution of slavery, writes Kasparov, which, critically, even some of its defenders at the time understood as evil. But comparing American statues of Columbus to those of Robert E. Lee fails this test of context. The call for objectivity applies also to those who would judge a 15th century European who took outrageous risks and performed incredible feats of exploration to advance modern civilization. The other thing is that Robert E. Lee is known only for one thing, for fighting against his country. Columbus is known for, yes, some tough things that are impossible to justify, but also heroic achievements. Known for heroic achievements, also James Bond, not to compare him to either Columbus or Robert E. Lee, but he is in Daniel Craig in his last Bond movie. Listen.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
James Bond is back. Bond with a familiar main squeeze, French actress Léa Seydoux, but a new arch-villain with a new super weapon, Oscar winner Rami Malek in the 25th 007 adventure, No Time to Die, now playing at theaters everywhere.
James Bond.
What does he want?
Revenge.
You can imagine why I've come back to play.
And yeah, there's lots of the play you would expect, but also a more serious, somber tone, with dark secrets revealed and less double entendre humor, instant seduction, and far-fetched chase scenes than you'd expect from this franchise. And yes, it's a more mature Bond, with a richer performance than ever before by Daniel Craig, and a generous running time of 2 hours and 43 minutes. Yes, it's slow and even repetitive at times, but fans will still find there's no time to sleep with No Time to Die. Rated PG-13, 3 stars for No Time to Die. And on the Michael Medved Show, we'll be back with a dispute about marijuana and COVID. If marijuana is held to be such a good wonder drug and great for everybody, why does it seem to be correlated so very closely with breakthrough cases of COVID-19? And single adults earn more money than married? No, the opposite. Why is that? We'll get to that and much more in this greatest nation on God's green earth.